The Giant Thinkers.
Giant Thinkers Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. I'm Ram Castillo, and in this podcast, I'm bringing to you top experts from various industries worldwide to learn from their success and to help us become better designers, creatives, and giant thinkers. Giants, welcome to episode number 88. Today's guest is the former Global Senior Vice President of Design and Marketing at Fossil Group. Now, Fossil Group offers its products across its proprietary brands, such as Fossil, of course, Skagen, I think it's pronounced Skagen in Denmark, Misfit, Michelle, Relic, and Zodiac, and under the licensed brands that include Armani Exchange, Diesel, DKNY, Emporio Armani, Kate Spade New York, Michael Kors, Puma, Tory Burch, Skechers, and even BMW. Now, here's an incredible fun fact. He was actually the first full-time designer hired for Fossil Group in 1987 and continued on for a whopping 30 years. During his 30-year tenure, the company grew from $5 million to $3 billion in sales. At its apex, he managed a multidisciplined creative team of 108. That included capabilities for all brand communications, marketing, packaging design, photography, pre-press, and web authoring for 4 owned brands and 13 licensed brands. Now, some of the topics we spoke about include his secret to longevity, energy drainers and energy givers, what makes a brand special and different, non-negotiables for when hiring the right person for the right role, how to get the best out of your team, insights to problem solving, and plenty more. So if you are someone that's interested in self-inquiry, self-reflection, and developing qualities within yourself for longevity as a creative and entrepreneur, then this episode is for you. A quick note from me, I invite you to follow me on Instagram via my handle, The Giant Thinker, if we're not already. I do share daily posts and stories on helping decision makers, business owners, and leaders get unstuck through human-centered design methodologies, creative strategies, and personal experiences. Branding's in the mix too. So send me a DM. I would love to hear from you. You can find me on my handle, The Giant Thinker. All right, let's dive straight into it. I present to you the highly pragmatic, down-to-earth, and kind-hearted Tim Hale. Tim Hale, welcome to the Giant Thinkers podcast. Mate, I'm very excited to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. This is a privilege. I consider it an honor to be on this podcast.
Thank you so much, mate. We've connected online virtually for a few years, I think.
Yeah.
How did we actually cross paths? Do you know?
I think it was really early when you started this, is what I recall. Ram, is that we started it. Yeah. We started having conversations about design management and, you know, kind of my experience in that with having been at Fossil for as long as I was at Fossil, kind of what my journey looked like. I just remember connecting with you early on when you were starting this and thought it was a really cool format. Thought it was a really neat thing that you were doing. And it's exciting to me that you've continued to do it. How many years have you been doing it now?
It's coming up to 2015. So yeah, good six and a half years or so.
Yeah. So actually you caught me right kind of in the back end of my career because and we'll talk about that later, but I left Fossil in 2017. So I was actually in 2015, I think, right around there was doing kind of brand work on the last brand that I worked on for Fossil. It was the Misfit brand. It was the connected brand that Fossil purchased and started, you know, really helped them, catapulted them or accelerated them in a way into the connected space for watches.
Well, mate, I'm excited to dive into all that sure. And I actually was so surprised. This is the beauty about the show and you know, just the speaking of connectivity, right? Like the ability to cross paths with each other. I think we connected on Tim and I connected on LinkedIn and we sent each other a few messages and I looked Tim up and I was like, goodness me, Tim's done a lot for this brand called Fossil. And I was almost blown away and of course, so humbled that you would be one of the early listeners of the show. So Tim, usually I start with an icebreaker question. And I was going to ask you something, but now I'm changing it because I'm looking at Tim via Zoom here and we've got these amazing posters and you've got four guitars hanging on your wall. Tell us about the five, six. Oh my gosh, he's just turned the camera down. There we go. Tell us about that because I have to now ask you a bit about this.
Okay, so it really, you know, you asked earlier on if this takes you down a certain path, go down this path. And the path is that early on in my childhood, I realized that I had been given two gifts and one was creativity and one was music. And you would say both are creative arts. So I was really, I would say, abundantly blessed in that way. And I kind of realized that early on as a kid, you know, started singing and performing when I was like 8, 9 years old. Continued with that through high school. At the same time, my parents had me in art lessons and voice lessons at the same time. And so I had a family that was really encouraging me to be creative, even though both of them were bankers, which is interesting. That's an interesting story too. You know, from a parental standpoint, what you support your kids in. But they were very encouraging in that. And so I just had the ability and the opportunity to explore both of those gifts pretty much my whole life. And, you know, as is true in a lot of, I would say, in a lot of homes, I was raised in a family, it was a Christian family, raised in the church. And so a lot of my music was around the church when I was growing up, but did grow up on country and later in my teens, a lot of classic rock and, you know, just, I loved it all. I was in a little, like what we call a 50s classic rock band when I was in high school. And so had that. And in high school, I was taking art and actually, you know, this is probably one of the lessons or one of the milestones from my development, I would say, is that I had an art teacher that pulled me aside because I was really thinking about majoring in music when I went to school. And I had a teacher that pulled me aside and said, "Hey, what are you planning on doing when you get to college?" And I was like, I'm gonna be a, you know, like a music pastor. I'm gonna be a music, going to music, probably in the church." And she's like, "Well, you know," she goes, "there's a lot of people that can do that, but there are not a lot of people that can do what you can do in art." And it actually was very much a pivotal moment for me. She was like, "Have you ever thought about going into commercial art?" And I was like, "No, not really. I don't even know what that is. I mean, this is late 70s. And I said, "I don't even know what commercial art was." I had really dabbled in like a lot of fine art and Western art and things growing up. And she just saw something in me that she felt like, because of the speed with which I worked and the way that I processed ideas, that she thought that I'd be really good at that. And so as a consequence of that, I ended up majoring in art in college. And so you think about the words that you say, you know, the lesson I learned from that early on was you can change the trajectory of somebody's life by the things you speak into them. And I think a lot of times we don't realize that when we're interacting, especially with young people, if you're interacting with young people, you know, the things that you speak into them can actually have a dramatic impact on where they go. And so that was that's a sidebar. That was for free, Ram.
But hey, I love this.
But I went on into college, still wrestled with the music art thing while I was in college. And my junior year in college, I ended up getting engaged, ended up marrying. And, you know, very soon after, we were expecting, my wife and I were expecting our first child. And it was like, I got to make a living. And so I really knuckled down on the art side of what I was learning, and actually got a job with First Agency while I was still in school, in Waco, Texas, and started doing that, started doing the work. And the guy that I worked for, another pivotal, I would say milestone thing that happened in my career, was this guy had been a teacher at the university, had started a small agency, was very, I would say, in-house minded, in the sense that, you know, this was when Mac didn't exist, computers didn't exist. We were doing everything by hand. You know, I learned how to do industrial illustration with an airbrush. I learned how to retouch photographs. I learned how to print. I printed photographs. I was a photographer some in college. And so he came in one day and set a Hasselblad camera on my desk and said, "Hey, you're shooting a catalog next week." You know, it was that kind of like stretching experience early in my in my career. But he was very minded on, if you're a designer, you should, or you're creative, you should be able to do these things. You should have the ability to do these things. And so he was just very, for me to be not out of school yet, it was a very stretching, you know, stretching moment for me in terms of stretching my thoughts around what I could do and what I built, what built confidence in me about what I had the capability to do, if I put my mind to it and I was given the opportunity. And so that became very pivotal as well. And knowing that I had the capability of doing that, I mean, I had grown up in a pretty small town in Texas, and already was starting to understand, hey, I could have a bigger impact than maybe what I thought in doing this. And so I worked there until I graduated. And upon graduation, I had a college buddy that contacted me and said, "Hey, my dad's got a company in Dallas. We need somebody to help us set up an art studio for the business. Can you come run that for us?" I mean, right out of college. And I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I showed up, did that, set up the studio. I automated some of the processes that they had because of some of the knowledge I had gained at the agency, and almost automated myself out of a job. My first, like I would say, real job out of college. And so the owner of the business actually was a former pro athlete, played for the Dallas Cowboys. And yeah, he was somebody I had kind of almost idolized as a kid, watching him, you know, play on Sundays. And here's, he's signing my paycheck. So it was pretty cool. But he said, "Well, you've got this kind of locked down. I have these other business acquaintances. I've had these other businesses. Would you like to set up an agency and start running that agency?" And just do cold calls and start trying to attract clients and that type of thing. And, you know, I was young and green and probably a little bit naive. And I was like, "Yeah, I can do that." So started doing that, learned a lot about sales, learned a lot about making connections with people, building relationships, you know, how to deliver, you know, a product and deliver on what you say. And so worked through that. And in the course of doing that, I met, in the course of cold calling and references, I met Tom Cartsotis, who was the guy that started Fossil. And when I met him, there were about five people working for what was then Overseas Products International. And it was a small import company. And worked for him kind of on contract, almost he was a client basis. And then I left the organization that I had joined at a college. I left and started freelancing, and kind of, they were one of my main clients. And I did that for about a year. And then because of some personal things from with my wife's mother, we were going to have to move out of the area. And Tom approached me and said, "Hey, I don't want you to move. We've got something good. You know, our relationship's really good. I like working with you. Is there anything we can set up?" And so at that point I was hired, and that was in 1987, I was hired as a first designer at Fossil, and took all my art studio stuff that I had at the house that I've been freelancing with, which is basically a drafting table and all the stuff that goes with that, took that and put it in the corner of a warehouse, like literally in the corner of a warehouse. And that's where my career with Fossil began.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a real fast explanation of how I landed at Fossil. But one of the, you know, the interesting things that I just touched on briefly there was, again, somebody early on in my career, this first agency I worked for early in my career was, you know, this guy, his name was Jack Fortenberry, and he had his flat sides for sure. I mean, I laugh now about some of the stuff that I used to put up with Jack, but he had a good heart, and he had a heart for young talent, had a heart for developing talent, and really, really helped me early on in my career understand that, yeah, I could do more and it could be done in-house. And that's really, you know, fast forward, jump to kind of my mindset early on in my career was another pivotal moment was for me. I was reading you probably don't even know this magazine. There used to be a magazine that existed. It was called Metropolis Magazine. I think it was published out of either California or New York. It was a design oriented magazine, but it was more about the general concept of what design is. And so it was a magazine that wasn't just about print design or about, you know, marketing. It was this idea of design as a profession, which really I hadn't really formulated, you know, that idea or opinion about, even though I was in the design industry. It was always about you work for an agency or you work for a design studio. And really had not connected the dots at that point about, hey, you could be a car designer, you could be an architect, you could be an interior designer, you could be lots of things you could be doing that would qualify as design. And this magazine in one particular article boiled that all down and basically kind of said the same thing that Jack had said to me early on was, hey, you could do a lot more if you put your mind to it. And it's really about if you have the nuts and the bolts and the insight and the talent, you can stretch that any direction you want to. If you understand the fundamentals, you know, it's like sports. If you understand the fundamentals, there's a lot of sports you can do if you understand, you know, fundamentals of fitness and fundamentals of strength and some of those things. It's the same way I believe in design. And that's what the philosophy I began to operate under was that you could do more with the creativity. And so I really began to build on that. And one of the things I also observed early on was, you know, companies like Herman Miller, companies like Nike, they were the pioneers, honestly. I got to give them credit for that. And there were others, a lot of other, you know, it came out of the 40s and the 50s, a lot of industrial companies that really focused on design. You think about Raymond Loewy and some of the stuff he did, you know, streamlined stuff, and all had a design mindset, but that was being done in-house. These companies are doing it in-house. And that's not to say that, you know, bringing contractors in or whatever is not a good thing, but the ability to control a brand and mold a brand and form a brand, I mean, you see it, it's pervasive now in our business culture, is that's what people do. They do startups and if they do it well, they start by developing what that brand ethos is, and it develops from there, and they build their audience and they build their tribe and they do all those things. And that's the way it's done, by and large, I would say. And so my thought process early on was that is like, it can be done in-house as well as it's done out of house. And it might even be better because you can go faster. You can be more fluid in making decisions. You can get more connected to the business, which came later in my career, but understanding, hey, this is what actually motivates the business forward. This is what actually moves the ball down the fields, as it were, for this particular company, for this particular organization. Depending on what phase of the business we're in, this is what actually is creating revenue and creating success. So how do you mold and attach design to that? This is stuff I didn't learn in school, honestly. What, again, an epiphany for me as a designer early on in my career was I didn't really know how to manage a studio. And I would say even, you know, didn't have a lot of business management in my background. What I began to understand is I could look at business the same way you look at it as a design problem. So in commercial design, what I was taught early on is this idea of gestalt and the fact that you have dominance in your design. You have things that need to be more important because of the message you're trying to convey. Business works the same way. There's things that need to be dominant in the business in order to convey what you're trying to sell, in order to try to really capture the attention of the audience that you're trying to capture the attention of. Bad way to say that, but this idea of, if you're trying to capture attention, you're going to pay more attention to these things. And early on, I started to realize that with Fossil, that, hey, these are the things that make us move. So this is the stuff we need to like put at the front. And this is the stuff that's not as important. And I started to do that in the way I managed people and the way I managed talent, in terms of like finding talent that connected with what was important at the company. And I would say early on, that was the success of the organization in terms of creativity, was that creativity was directly related to what really motivated and drove the company and really got people's attention. So I've been doing a lot of talking. I'll let you ask.
Man, that's fantastic. Wow. You've come out of the gate swinging, Tim. I was going to say, I'm looking at my questions here and I think you've answered like four of them. I love it. There's a few, there's more than a few. There's a lot of topics and themes there that I'd love to unpack a little bit. Well, I'll go back to the second question on my list, but I'm just interested to see what your answer is for this. But where would you say your expertise lies then?
I think my expertise lies, and I found this is a developed trait, but the ability to gain insight into what makes a brand special. What is going to resonate and what are the qualities behind you're going to be able to build on. I would say the building, being able to unpack a brand and look at it and go, okay, well, here's the essence of it. This is, Simon Sinek talked about the why. And I think that's a really important point that he makes. But I found that's at the heart of pretty much every brand that I worked on, is you have to find a seminal point that differentiates it. And I think the danger in that too is that understanding that what that seminal point is for a brand, sometimes you may have to decide, hey, that's what makes this brand special, but it may not ever be like huge. It may have a finite space that it's going to fill because of it being that way. And I think the trap that a lot of brands fall into is they're not comfortable with that. It's like it gets to a certain size and it's like, oh, I want it to be bigger. I want it to be bigger. And you start making compromises on those qualities. And unintentionally, you will either damage or undermine the long-term growth or sustainability of it.
So on that then, Tim, what makes a brand special? One way is being different.
Right.
And now after your entire experience at Fossil, what is your definition of a brand and how does one find differentiation?
Yeah. Probably my definition of a brand is its personality. That's the only way I could ever quantify it. It's not unlike people you meet. You meet people and you start to understand the qualities of those people and you're either drawn to them and you find resonance with them and you build community with them, or you don't, for one reason or another. And brands are really the same way. They're, we used to do this exercise in brand building or brand definition of, and I still love doing this exercise, but it's, we're this, not that. And the way you get it and the way you get through those, that analysis of we're this, not that, is you use other known things. It could be car brands. It could be soft drinks. It could be restaurants. It could be clothing brands. It could be a number of things that people already have an impression of. And they'll differentiate based on those brands. If you allow them the time to do that, they may say, well, I prefer Coke over Pepsi. Well, why do you prefer Coke over Pepsi? Well, they have reasons why. And a lot of times in brand definition, what we would do is say, well, is this like Coke or is it like Pepsi? Or is this like Mountain Dew? Or is it like, you know, is it like something else? Is it like Dr. Pepper? You know, whatever that is. Or is this, you know, you can go down the beer path. You can go down all kinds of paths with that. It really is a thing that you start to understand what people's cultural reference points are and that they've developed perception around quality and around appeal and those types of things. They've developed a perception of those things based on other things. And so if you can put that in front of them, they'll start to align some of those with your brand for one reason or another. And I find that to be a really fascinating exercise because it's really about exploring the personality of the brand.
That's excellent. Thanks for inserting that exercise. So I think we can use that straight away, that association of this versus where this, not that. So Tim, I just wanted to hone in on one very important thing because I usually ask guests on the show, tell us a little about your childhood, and you did that and more, which was fantastic. One thing that I did want to hone in on is you said at the very beginning, you can something along the lines of you can speak to someone and change the trajectory of where they go.
Right.
I totally agree. But I think there's also the openness of that individual to have the propensity to explore.
Yes.
And I find that not everyone has that either. So it's one thing for a mentor, and you know that I love mentorship. I wrote my second book about how to get one.
Right.
But how, for people that are maybe not in fertile ground, so to speak, you know, especially young students, you might be thinking about career in design, or you might be already having maybe your third or fourth career change. I speak to a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, 50s who want a pivot, a career change. And so for those that are not exposed to that too much, you know, might be passed down the beliefs and thoughts from their parents. They might have inherited behaviors that might not be serving them, all that stuff. For those that are now hearing this for the first time and going, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, someone, you know, now that I look back, maybe there are people that I can reach out to or who have said, you know, XYZ, here's an opportunity. They've extended their hand, but I've not picked it up. I've been too scared, you know, or I've had doubts within myself that I'm not going to be able to perform and I don't want to disappoint people. How does one break through that mindset of, well, there is an opportunity here. Someone's given me that chance, or I can reach out to someone and ask to give me a chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole, it's that one conversation. That's what I find so powerful. A seed can be a conversation, an interaction. You might've met someone and they're willing to give you a chance. They're willing to do mm-hmm. something which might change the direction of where you go, as with what happened to you. How does one start to hone in on that and really lean in to being brave and courageous to, you're not there yet, but this is something where it might help you get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I'm not a counselor. I've been a coach I would like to think I've been a coach for a lot of people in their careers in terms of just, you know, talking to them about what they're doing and what I feel like their potential is and what their gifts and abilities are and those types of things. I've had those types of opportunities and I've never taken that lightly. I've always felt like that was really important because of my own experience. I think the big thing, one of the things there that you spoke to is, if you're brought up in an environment that's not the norm for you, and it could be cultural, honestly. I mean, I've met a lot of, you know, people that I've worked with through the years, depending on what culture they've come from, that's just not their tradition. That's not the tradition of their culture to be innovative thinkers or be open thinkers. The idea that you're more tied to tradition and you're more tied to following a set of rules because it's handed down to you, you know, from the last generation, future, you know, the last generation knows better than you, those types of things. Or it's not the cultural tradition to question authority at all. Can be, I mean, those can be real roadblocks. Those can be real stumbling blocks, I think. So I think the first piece, which we live in a more, I would say, more open world, a more information-rich world now, where these concepts, I think, are more commonly shared, you know, it through the internet, through social media, through things that you come in contact with, either directly or indirectly, regardless of culture, which has been, to me, has been an amazing thing to observe in my lifetime. But the first step is actually personally recognizing that, hey, I may not be in this spot where I'm, that I know these things or that I'm coachable. And there has to be some self-realization in that, that says I need help. And that's whether it's going and getting information and finding information and being open to information, or, you know, I was always told it was wise to seek wise counsel. So seeking wise counsel, that's something you have to kind of humble yourself about. Like, you got to be willing to say, okay, I'm willing to take a hit if I have a flat side, or I'm not doing something the way I need to be doing, or, you know, whatever that looks like. And so there's an openness. You talked about an openness. There's an openness. There's a first, a self-realization of, hey, I could possibly be better. This may not be the way the world actually is, or has to be, because of the circumstances I'm in, but I need to find somebody in my path that can help me find a different path. And so seeking out wise counsel is probably the first step in that.
Hey, that's powerful stuff. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Now, Tim, when I think about being in a company for 30 years, one word screams to mind, and that's longevity.
Yeah.
So how did you stay in one company for that long?
I started to really recognize opportunities. Like, I started to look for opportunity and everything. So if a problem was brought, if I saw a problem, I started to recognize the problem. And then I really started to understand, hey, this is problematic. Let's fix this. And so I'd be able to identify problems and create opportunity from those problems before I was asked. And so having that deeper knowledge that way and performing that way, I really felt like had a lot to do with my longevity there, because that just continued to be my MO, and my own ability morphed with the organization. As the organization morphed, I was kind of following the organization as it morphed, because I was always thinking about, or, you know, once I had the ability to be in, and I was in a lot of those conversations. I mean, when I joined the company, there were only around 15 people in the company. And so the company morphed from 15 to like 15,000 when I left. It morphed from being a US-based organization to having offices in 100 countries. You know, it went through just huge dynamic shifts in terms of organizational growth. And so I got to witness that. I mean, it really is a privilege, frankly, to look back on that and understand what I had the opportunity to experience through that, and be a part of that, and see the pitfalls. It wasn't all good. There were some struggles, and there were some, you know, some down times and good times. A lot of it was good. And a lot of it, obviously, because the organization grew from, when I joined the company, we were doing somewhere around 5 million in sales. And when I left the company, they were doing 3 billion in sales. So you get to, I never kind of said this a lot, but fortunately the CEO would say this, is like, the creativity was really the heartbeat of the organization. And so to be part of that and know that you had something to do with that, was just really, you know, I couldn't have asked for more in terms of a fulfilling career to have known you had a hand in part of that. So the opportunity aspect was the thing that I always even tell young professionals now. It's like, you need to, don't wait for somebody to tell you what to do. Don't wait for somebody to tell you what to do. You need to know enough about the organization and enough the brand that you're working on or the client you're working with. You need to know, you need to be a student of their business or a student of your business to the point where somebody doesn't have to ask me what to do next. I should be coming with a flurry of ideas of, we could be doing this, or we could be doing this, or we could be doing this, because it fits what the problem is.
Mate, you've hit the nail on the head there with so much of what I align to as well, in terms of looking at problems as opportunities straight up. Yeah. That's a key. Yeah. I also was just thinking about, as you were talking and reflecting on your career, with the longevity piece, that it is indeed a marathon, and there is so much patience to that substantial amount of time. And I often think of energy drainers and energy gainers, you know, right, things that take away and things that provide and give you more of. Have you identified any energy drainers and energy givers, so to speak, in your life, both personally and professionally, that helped you along that journey?
Yeah. And yeah, I think I spoke to you kind of on a note to you. You know, I said earlier on, I was raised in the church. You know, I profess to be a Christian. I have deep faith. And because of that, my worldview and my view about the gifts that I have and the way I use those gifts and the impact I have on people, honestly, is different. I mean, it just is. And it from my upbringing, what I believe, it should be different. Like it should show up. You know, it's actually not unlike what Simon Sinek talks about. You know, this is my why. Well, if that's your why, then that's going to resonate in everything you do. And so I feel like that's had a lot to do with it, because it's made me, I don't really elevate myself over other people. I feel like we're all on the same playing field and we all have value and worth. And that's what I believe the Bible teaches. I mean, if I could be so bold as to say that, is that we're all on the same playing field. Doesn't matter what color skin is, doesn't matter what economic, you know, place we come from, culturally, whatever. We're all coming from the same place. And if that's the case, then anything that happens to me that's on the up and up, or that I have an advantage in, is really a blessing. Like, it's a gift. And so I need to treat it that way. And that means I have to be a good steward of the talent. I need to be the good steward, steward of the time that I have here on the planet. I need to be a good steward and a good citizen to other people and the way I treat people. I need to see people the same way I think that I'm seen, in terms of value and worth. And because of that, it just changes the way that I lead. And I think that's, you talked about the longevity. I think that's also what showed up in the way that I led people, and allowed me to stay there so long, because I felt like I was developing people. As much as I was developing brands and developing those other things, I felt like I was investing in people the whole time I was at Fossil. And that is, you call it noble, call it whatever you want to, but I really felt like that was the calling, or if you want to call it that. And that's what I needed to be doing in that season of my life.
And this all goes back to that awareness piece of, can you recognize that this could change the trajectory of your life? And we attach that to someone, a person, but it's also information. There's information here. I mean, the first thing that came to mind, and, you know, just to call it out, like, it depends on your culture. I mean, Filipino culture, where I'm from,
right,
it's over 85% Catholic. Right. And I resonate with the Christian faith immensely. And even for the simple fact of how small you are in the grandness of everything else, And right. that, you know, there's even by the definition of faith or whatever you or whoever you are believe in, it's that notion that we don't have all the answers and that, yeah. that there is this world out there and, you know, how are we making use of the gifts and talents that we have? But one thing that I was reminded of with that beautiful share there, Tim, a mentor of mine said to me early on that if you have a plan for yourself, you'll only impact yourself. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
However, if you have a plan for humanity, then you'll impact humanity.
Right.
And I guess, you know, this is what it is as well with longevity and, you know, some people refer to it as a calling, but you just put it down to people. And I guess in many ways, Fossil and or the organization that any one of us work at, it's just the vehicle to carry those values mm-hmm. of what's fulfilling to us. Mate, I wanted to talk about.
Could I stop you just for a second? I
want to answer one please.
More. So the antithesis of that, because you ask about, you know, what are the energy drainers? The energy drainers, honestly, is to me the antithesis of that. When you start to have a lot of pride, and I say when I say pride, you can have pride in the work you do, and you should have pride in the work you do. You should want to do good work, but when you develop this, you know, over accentuated sense of pride in terms of puffing yourself up. And that happens in so many businesses. It happens in so many organizations where you see that. That just becomes, to me, a real energy drain on the organization. It becomes an energy drain on the organization. It creates a lot of inefficiency in the organization because then you start to have this idea of eroding trust, which, you know, everybody knows I think everybody probably knows the book, The Speed of Trust. So if you start to see that happen, the antithesis of this idea of valuing people, when that starts to erode, it can be a real detriment to the sustainability of the business, the viability of the business, and even the health of the environment, which, as we all know, if you don't have a healthy environment in a business, it's not going to reach the productivity level ultimately that it could.
That's excellent. I'm going to swing the needle now, Tim, to a different area. One that we briefly touched on about brand and mm-hmm. branding.
Yeah.
Because I often speak about the importance of a clear competitive advantage, and you spoke of that a bit earlier,
right.
on differentiation and what makes a brand special.
Right.
I often say that it's the intersection of what's appealing and what's exclusive. And
right.
in the intersection of that, you've got some form of a competitive advantage, and that if you don't have a competitive advantage, well, then that means something's not appealing enough,
right?
And or something's not exclusive enough that you can deliver.
Right.
So what would you say made Fossil so special back then when you started? And then in its from its inception to now, what do you think makes Fossil special now?
Yeah, I touched on it earlier, but I think the overt creativity of the organization, and there's a number of brands that you could speak to that you would say are probably similar in that in terms of having that same personality trait of being very design driven. We became very intentional about that early on. It's like, this is going to be one of the personality traits of this brand, is that people are not going to know what to expect next. Like, we're just going to dial that and just keep kicking stuff out, you know, as fast as we can. And from a competitive advantage standpoint, because we were doing that in-house, we had the ability, you know, to create this velocity of doing that was hard to keep up with. And so it became this thing, if you can you maintain this velocity of innovation and velocity of creativity, that yeah, somebody may copy you, but by the time they've copied you, you've moved way down the road. And so that was one key thing. I think one of the things that appealed to people early on with Fossil, and this was also intentional, is that it came from not so much myself, but our early Tom and his brother, who became principals in the organization very early on, were pretty well traveled in the sense that they had more of a global view of what was going on in retail, and understood that there was still this kind of romance with Americana, that the globe, as you know, as a globe, whether you're in Asia or in Europe or wherever you were, there was still some this very romantic notion about American culture, and especially post-World War II American culture, and just the naivete of it, and the prolific creativity. Really what we saw then was almost the cheekiness of it, and the humor was really interesting. And what we were seeing was that there were brands in Europe and in Asia alike that were really trying to leverage that. And it's like, well, if they're trying to do it, we could do it. You know, we could do it way better, because we've got all the resources right here. And, you know, this is one of those odd serendipitous things that happens. I told you I was in a 50s cover band. So I already had all this in my background anyway, where I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. And so it was just, when we started doing it, it was a lot of creative people just having a lot of fun designing stuff for ourselves, you know, that we felt like would have global appeal. And as it turned out, it did. And then there was a certain, the other part of it that I felt like was at that time a very appealing was that we took a very traditional notion about the values of the business and how we were going to conduct the business. And then it was that those core values and the way we were going to conduct the business would seem very much like they came from that very principled period of things are done on a handshake, and we stand by our word, and we stand behind our product, and all really, you know, good qualities. And that built a certain quality ethos into the way we did business that people really respected.
That's amazing. I thought about also the origin story of Fossil being originally as a Swiss made or Swiss owned. Was that right? Something about the Switzerland side of
the Swiss thing was actually, it was almost a bit of, oh yeah, we'll show you, because the first few times that we went to the Basel Watch Fair, we basically were treated pretty badly. Like the Swiss did not like it that there was these young upstart Americans coming to Switzerland and we're going to start a watch company. Like, how dare you? And the fact that we had Asian-based manufacturing didn't help either, because that was always kind of they're very much for a long time was a bit of a rub there, you know, in terms of Swiss made versus world made, as you might say, anything else other than Swiss made. And so that, you know, there was a little bit of, oh yeah, we'll show you. I'll tell you, know, honestly, from the very beginning. And that existed down to the point of even today. As far as I know, even today, and I can't remember what year we did that, but when we built the office in Basel, it was 5 minutes from the front door of the Basel Watch Fair. It was on the same street, and that was on purpose. So, you know, and then now the building that's there now, that I think the Swiss office is still there, is basically in the back door, almost in the back door of the Basel of the conference center. And I mean, we've become, you know, the company became Swiss citizens, as it were. So it's that's an interesting kind of fun, you know, underpinning story, you know, behind the scenes story that was going on in terms of some of the gamesmanship that was going on behind the scenes.
Wow.
In the industry.
That's juicy stuff. I love it. There you go. Don't believe everything you read, because obviously online just doesn't take long. And there's like all this stuff about Fossil being a Swiss origin brand.
No.
So it's not true. Thank you for clarifying that.
It started in Dallas. It started in Dallas, Texas. And the company literally started in Dallas, Texas by three guys that sat groceries together at a grocery store.
That's amazing.
That's the reality.
So, Tim, there was one article from the American Marketing Association where they made mention to, at one point, you manage a team of 108 people. 108. Yeah. Like, that's amazing. What is a non-negotiable that you look for when hiring the right person for the right role?
Non-negotiable for right person, right role.
Like, what do you look for?
Yeah, one of the things we talked about earlier, and that's curiosity. An inherent humbleness of, yeah, I don't have all the answers. I have a lot of talent. You know, it's obvious usually in their work that they have the talent. What I always looked for were people that were underimpressed with themselves, that had a lot of talent, but were underimpressed with themselves. And so they were still hungry, they're still willing to learn, and they're still willing to work really hard. And, you know, you can't buy a good attitude. And finding people that have a good attitude, that have the right level of pride in what they do, and they take pride in what they do, and they want to do a good job. That's different than being overly impressed with themselves. And I could find somebody that was super talented and won every award, you know, available. But more times than not, those people were so impressed with themselves, they were going to be hard to work with. And as a consequent, I would always go for what I would call the dark horse, you know, somebody that maybe hadn't had the opportunities that somebody else has had, but had done good work, and you could tell they were really hungry and wanted to work hard. And maybe I was reflecting, you know, maybe I was reflecting some of my own experience in that.
Absolutely. And so how, Tim, do you get the best out of a team member? And once you've identified that, they have that, they're now working for you. And then now you've got a team of 100 plus. How do you get the best out of those people and work as a team?
You try as much as you can to build personal connection with that person, to make them feel valued, to make them feel like they're seen, that their work is seen. And when you have the opportunity, and it may not be once a week, but once a week, if you have an opportunity to swing by their desk or engage with them and take take a sincere interest in what they're doing and try to provide them constructive feedback if constructive feedback's needed. And if constructive feedback's not needed, certainly telling them, hey, good job. You know, that honestly goes a long way. And I think we underappreciate or undervalue that people need encouragement.
Hey, that's very, very useful. Make them feel valued and seen and right. Provide constructive feedback. That's the keys right there. Tim, if you were obviously, I'll finish that thought. If you were to have encountered diverse opinions or a different opinion with one team member and another, or maybe a few different points of view.
Right.
How do you manage that diversity of thought and opinions, especially in a creative department, and realign a team back to focusing on the shared vision? You know, I'm sure sometimes people get passionate about their ideas.
Right.
Was there a time that you remember where you were really challenged by a diversity of thoughts and opinions and creative ideas, and how did you get the team back on track?
I think if you're in a creative environment, you want that to happen. I mean, I read a book one time, and I'm going to forget the design director's name. He was the director of Nissan for a while. And he used to have this kind of the very exaggerated view of that, of like, I want my designers to actually, you know, I'll put the two guys that disagree the most together, because out of the friction, good stuff comes. I was never that guy, honestly, but I did always want a lot of varying views to come out. Like, I would like, you know, I wanted to hear differing solutions. And the way that we typically managed that was always to go back to the problem. Like, never take it on face value of like, well, that's the best solution, or that's the best solution. Let's go back and explore the problem together. And let's talk about the problem. And let's start to answer the question, which one of these does a better job of actually solving the problem? And I think that was always the neutral ground, as it were. And I always used to tell, you know, a lot of the people that I work with or designers, that there's typically a third answer. You know, there can be this answer and there can be that answer. And sometimes there's a third answer that combines some of the things that maybe both of you have vetted out, have sussed out. And there may be a third solution that actually uses some of both that actually ends up being the best solution. So that was always my course in dealing with those types of disagreements, if you want to call them disagreements or varying opinion, was let's go back to the problem and really explore what takes, you know, what really provides the best solution.
That's great. I love that. Put two people with very differing views together, and out of the friction, good things come. Probably not to the person facilitating it watching right. This manic chaos, but right. I totally agree with that. And then you mentioned explore the problem, which of these ideas does a better job at solving the problem, and really making that the North Star, which gives me this sort of thought here, Tim. What are the most important questions we need to ask when finding a customer insight? So yeah. We've identified there's a problem, we're trying to solve it. How do we draw out an insight that, of course, is still a hypothesis, but there are some hypotheses which are very likely true and until right. proven or disproven. But how does one arrive at a hypothesis or a customer insight in a world where so many people have side hustles and so many people want to create stuff and they want right. to launch a business?
Yeah.
What are the most important questions we need to ask to find a customer insight?
To me, one of the things was always is what was the origin story behind whatever it is we're doing? What is the origin story? Like, where did this originate? Like, how did it come to be, especially with brand work? Because a lot of times there'll be really nuggets of information that made something work in its inception that for whatever reason have been lost. I found this to be true in a lot of the brands that Fossil acquired, is that you would do a deep dive on what's the origin story of this brand. And what I oftentimes found out is all the nuance of why the founder or the entrepreneur or whoever it was started this business, that in that nuance were really the diamonds of, hey, there's something, why aren't you talking about that? Like, why aren't we talking about that? And so that always to me was a lot of fun. Like, I always felt like that was just, you know, you're mining gold is what you're trying to do. And to me, that's where I always started. And if you ask, you know, what's the most important question? Well, how did this originate is to me is the most important question. If I reflect on the brand like Skagen, we did, or Skagen as it's actually supposed to be pronounced in Denmark. When we purchased that brand and Fossil started redoing that brand, what we found was there was a lot of cultural nuance in that brand or available in that brand that had not been exploited. And was, in fact, it had kind of been commercialized to the point where it just didn't feel special anymore. And so the opportunity was to take it back to the origin and say, no, we're going to make this as pure, you know, in Danish design and a European mindset as we possibly can. And that will make it look very different than Fossil and differentiate it in the marketplace. And I feel like they've still held true to some of that. But that was a very fun process.
That's great. That's very great. Was there ever a time where you had a strong point of view or an opinion, you know, speaking of this sort of, you know, the teams and managing all them, but for you, was there ever a time where you had a strong point of view and then somehow your perspective was changed? And how was that perspective changed? Because and there's a sort of part two to this, which is that I've noticed that with all this, you know, quote unquote successful, whatever that might be, to you, but there are these people who have done well for themselves in their careers, in, you know, their brand building or in any type of equity, especially of course internal, but there is this correlation between having difficult conversations and the success that they've had. And in those difficult conversations, there is this friction of having two opposing views often, or, you know, that when have you had a point of view that's been something that you had for some substantial amount of time, but then it changed when someone helped you change that point of view and you were open to seeing a different side to something?
That's a hard question, actually.
It is hard. And I guess the reason why I ask it as well is because there needs to be an open-mindedness as a designer, as a creative person, to be less defensive and more constructive. And I'm finding this to be something that is not so much addressed in the world of design. It's like people get so passionate and then it's like, It sometimes dilutes the whole point. It's like, well, hold on, you know, how do we become less biased? Mm-hmm. How do we not say that this is the one great idea and I swear it's been validated? Well, no, as designers, we actually need to be a bit more open-minded, I think.
I had to change my mind about connected devices a little bit. I would say probably it was late in my career. I had I wouldn't say an issue. I just, you know, it just was not something that necessarily appealed to me. And so I had to come to a place where a lot of things I've talked about earlier, like Fossil, you know, really appealed to me. Zodiac really appealed to me. The work that I did on Skagen or Scan really appealed to me. Like every project I took on had the opportunity. And I think part of it was just because it was the ability to unpack it and rebuild it. And so all of those things had a lot of appeal to me. When it came to Misfit, honestly, I was kind of taking off a role on Skagen and said, hey, this is the next thing we're doing. Go do this thing. And I was just kind of like, really?
Wearables, right? Wearable tech.
Right, yeah. It's like wearable tech. Like, that's going to be the thing I'm going to, like, I don't feel equipped to do this. So I think that was probably, you know, ended up being kind of a bit of my swan song at Fossil, but it wasn't because it wasn't successful. I felt like we were really successful at, again, going back to the origins of that brand and understanding what made it tick and why was it named Misfit and some of those things. I had to be convinced, honestly, that there was, you know, there was a really good reason for us to do that. And so yeah, that's probably the thing that I can think about in a reflection of, it didn't have as much of the romantic nuance of some of the other brands I'd worked on, but I understood the value and the importance of it because of it having a connected and a technology element, and it was going to move the whole organization to a different place. And so I was able to get behind it because of that. And Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think they're trying to reinvent that brand now to be something else, because they pulled a lot of the technology out of it and put it in other places in the company, and that was the reason, honestly, that they purchased it in the to begin with. But I would say that was probably, yeah, in all my years, that was probably one of the bigger things that it's like, no, you can do this. We need you to do this. And so I had to kind of put more of a professional hat on and say, okay, I'm going to go do this because it's the right thing to do. And I do know how to do it. I feel like I can bring value to it and move it forward. So.
Yeah, that's a great example. That's a really great example. I think a lot of people can connect with that, especially when they're not the ideal customer necessarily, or the primary customer. Right. You do have a sense of that. Oh, I've been there so many times. Yeah. That's great. So Tim, a question I ask all my guests: if you could travel back in time and speak to junior Tim to junior Tim for 30 seconds, perhaps the youngster finishing high school, what would you tell him?
Manage your money better. No, honestly, that's the truth.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, that's probably the truth. It's just, you know, I would have, I think we're all inclined to, you know, jump on the, I don't know the right way to term it, but we can all become a little more materialistic than we need to be. And probably the better way to say that was, you know, be content with less. I found in this season of my life where I'm at now, and it was part of the reason for doing, is that we just got to point where my wife and I both were kind of looking at each other going, what are we doing? Like we could be doing something that's, you know, more purposeful, in this season of our life. And we don't need so much stuff. Like you just don't. And I think part of that was I had that, you know, with my career, I had the opportunity to travel a lot. Ended up getting to do some mission work with the church we were going to. And you just to start to understand that, you know, so many of us are so privileged. I mean, so many of us live in really, really the ethos of the 5 to 10% of the planet. And it just gave me an awareness to the point of like saying that, you know, yeah, don't be content with less and you'd be a lot happier.
Powerful. Mate, who has been an impactful giant thinker in your life? That person who has inspired you to think bigger and dig deeper in helping you reach your full potential?
This will sound really cliche, but my dad. Yeah. I mean, it's really, you know, as cliche as that might sound, but that, you know, I spoke to that early on, is that he never, you know, he had a financial mindset and he never limited me to be creative, and was always pushing to, whether it was music or whether it was art, like you can do it. You can do more, you can do more, you can do more, you can do more. And, you know, he did ask me at one point when I was in college, he's like, I don't know how you're going to make a living, but this is great.
the thought on most parents who have children pursuing a creative career, right?
Right.
Tim, what's next for you with everything you're involved in, you know, for the rest of the year, next year and beyond? You're working on some interesting stuff. Do you want to share?
Sure. So I'm, you know, in 2017, I exited Fossil and really felt like that the company was at a pivotal time, continues to be in a repositioning mindset. If you listen to analyst calls or anything with Fossil, they talk about New World Fossil. And that really is a, you know, reposturing of the organization. And I had, you know, spoke to this early on, but I really got to the point where I started to understand that was happening, the writing on the wall, as it were, that was going to be required for the organization to continue to be sustainable, that it was going to have to reposition itself and rescale, resize, if it was going to continue to be viable. And with it being a public health company, You know, it's got to hit its metrics, and it's got to have some, maintain some profitability for it to be viable. And so I really started to understand that in 2016, and just really started to do some soul searching about what's next for us. And my wife and I always said that we would like to go or potentially end up some type of either mission work or ministry related work. And, you know, ideally that would be around young people. And my kids had intended a camp, you know, just a summer youth camp, as it were, when they were growing up. And we'd always said, well, it'd be pretty neat if we got to ever lean into that organization, because they had a tremendous impact on our kids. And the opportunity came up for me to become the development director, which is fundraising for the organization. And later my wife became registrar, is the lead registrar and administrator for the organization. The name of the organization is New Life Ranch. And so we've been doing that for 4 years, almost going on five now. And it's just a different motivation, I would say, for why we're doing what we're doing. I think I wrote you something, or maybe put it in my bio, Rom, that the motivation there is really to do what was done to me. And that's to speak into lives of as many young people as I can in this season of my life and say, hey, these are some things you might want to consider, because they'll make a difference in the long race that we call a marathon. And if you want to develop a different perspective on how to lead, you know, my faith tells me that, you know, there's this idea of servant leadership. You can serve people and still lead. And that's about influence. It's not about whether you're the title on the wall or what's on your business card. It's about how you serve people. And because you choose to do that rather than try to take the lead all the time, that you probably be given the lead position because of your influence in people's lives. And so that's a different mantra, as it were. And so that's really what I want to spend this season of my life doing, is investing in other people, investing in young people. And I have the opportunity to do that through, you know, some music education that I do at the camp. I have the opportunity to do that in the summers of just being available. We have summer staff. We probably hire 240 college staff that come on our locations. We have two locations. And so there's a lot of interaction there. And I get to talk to a lot of parents. And so it's those types of, it's more relational, which I've always enjoyed, you know, and my wife and I both enjoy that aspect of the work we do now. So.
Well, Tim, I'm probably going to embarrass you now, but for the listeners, when I asked Tim if he'd be up for hopping on the show, Tim's response was this sort of, really, I'm flattered. It's been a while. I've completely changed spaces. I'm a humble little development director working for a nonprofit now. Although I work with a ton of purpose for the next generation, I'm not sure I rank in that group that of guests that I've had. And I was like, that's why I want you on the show. And yeah, I just wanted to insert that there, Tim, because it's very important, and you know, people can read between the lines, but yeah. You can have all the things in the world, but if you're not living in a way that I think helps and serves others in whatever way that might look like for you, yeah. Then I think, you know, it's just like David Lee, the global chief creative officer of Squarespace, said, is you don't want to be the richest person in the grave.
Yeah.
So thank you, mate. Appreciate your time. How can people get in touch with you online?
Yeah, if they want to get in touch with me online, my email address is tim@newliferanch.com. It's really easy. You can find we have a Facebook page, we have an Instagram page. I have an Instagram page under Small Town Design is kind of what I go by for that. So yeah, if you want to reach out to me and have further conversations, I'd love to do that.
Excellent. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you. Thank you, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. We'll be in touch.
Boom. There we have it, Giants. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I deeply appreciate you choosing to listen to this show. Hopefully you were able to grab some useful insights. Please send Tim a hi and hello either on the email that he shared or over on his LinkedIn. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. Now, if you are enjoying these episodes, I do have one ask, if I may be so bold. I'm asking for an iTunes review. It's minimum effort for maximum impact, because when you leave an iTunes review, you will help get the show in front of more people who might need it. Just head to giantthinkers.com/podcast review. That's giantthinkers.com/podcast review. It'll take you straight to it. Should take you all but 20 seconds. I read and appreciate every single one, but more importantly, as I mentioned, it does help get the show in front of more people. And we're able to share this to others who might really need these life lessons and stories from our world-class guests. A little teaser for the next episode. It's actually going to be a recording, a replay of a recording, of a coaching call, someone that I coached. And the reason why I'm going to put this on the podcast is because the questions asked by this individual were powerful and profound questions that I know everyone would be able to relate to and find quite interesting. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that with you all and for you all to hear it. Subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast app and you'll be notified as soon as that goes live. For any questions regarding the podcast or anything at all, the best way to reach me is on Instagram. Send me a message via my handle, TheGiantThinker, if we're not connected already. Lastly, I'll leave you with a quote that I loved from Tim, who said, "Look at business problems the same as design problems. There are things that need to be dominant in order to make us move. Put that at the front. The rest aren't as important."